Cape Talk. Family Matters.
Now, you're going to recognize the next voice you hear because he is a regular visitor to our studio. He's not allowed at the DIY event on Thursday, but Don McAllister often comes in as Handy Mac to chat to us about home improvement issues. Today, though, he's setting aside that hat to share something entirely different with us, and it's about the story of his search for his own roots. A little while ago, Don shared with me some of his adoption story, and I found it incredibly intriguing and moving, and we thought you would too, and I'm dying to hear the rest of the story. So, Don, always love to have you with us, but thank you so much for joining us particularly today to share this very special story with us.
Thank you. It's something I've always wanted to share with a lot of people, more so because I think there's been such a stigma over adoption. Mm. It was something that my mom, and when I say my mom, I mean my real mom, my adopted mom, was so shy. She didn't want anybody to know. It was all a secret. And I think there's so many people that need to get out there and meet their real parents. And you can have a happy relationship from both sides. Mm. I think my family that I grew up with, I had a better relationship with my mom, who I found. But it's so important that you realize your roots. There's medical things. There's all sorts of other things that come into it. But it's so, so important.
Okay. Well, thank you for what you're doing in just taking away that stigma entirely and sharing your story today. Did you always grow up knowing that you were adopted, or is it something that you clearly remember being told at some point in your life?
I think from about the age of 5 or 6, maybe even 4, my mom did speak to me and explained to me that I was different, and she wasn't my real mom, but she loved me very much. And it was just something that made me feel special. And I didn't really think anything about it until my mom died. And then I thought, it's time to look.
Did you deliberately not want to look before then because you didn't want her to be hurt by any sort of sense that she might not be enough?
I thought it wouldn't be the right thing to do. She'd given up her whole life for me, and I was going to keep it special for her.
Yeah, which meant that you were well into your 40s by the time you began looking, Don. And did you immediately know that you wanted to set out to find your birth parents, or was it something you grappled with even after you'd lost your mom?
I still grapple with it, if I did the right thing or not, but I think I did. My wife was very to the fore in getting me to do this. She's a genealogist, and it was a challenge for her as well to start trying to dig through hidden pieces of paper, really. When my mom died, she left a few clues, and I actually think both my mothers met at some stage.
It
was very strange back in the 50s, but we actually believe that they do. And I think my mom kept in contact with my birth mother
all that time without your knowing about it. Fascinating. You did, before your mom had passed away, you went to visit the place where you knew you were born, but you did that on the quiet, didn't you?
Well, it was on the quiet, and it was a very heart-sore moment. We'd been on a holiday in the UK for 6 weeks, and my son had his appendix out in Dundee. And they'd said to us, he must have his stitches out in a week's time. And we happened to be in Kendal. And I knew Kendal was where I was born. It was a home for unmarried mothers.
Yeah.
And I said to the nurse who was taking my son's stitches out, was there a home here for She says, were you one of the children?
Oh, my goodness.
I said, yes. She says, you're not going to like it. Go down the road and you'll see it's an old derelict house. So the family went down. We stood there and we cried and saw where I was born. But we went back last year.
And how had the experience changed for you to be back there now, having a much fuller sense of where you came from?
It's a little bit ironic because it's actually a home for dementia patients now. I hope I don't end up there again, but it was. But they wouldn't let me in because of it. It's the nature of the place, so we just stood outside. But we battled to find it. You know, it was an old manor house, which is now surrounded by a new housing estate.
Okay.
But that was an interesting trip last year because we met a half-brother I'd never met before, and I met my adoptive family. So it was a real...
A real extended family
reunion. It was a real weepy last year
UK. Now, let's talk about the looking. So you decided to wait until after your mom was gone, and it was only in 1997 that you then began looking in earnest with your wife's assistance. How easy or difficult was it for you to find information, Don? Because we're going back to the 50s, as you said. We're talking documents sitting in boxes on a shelf at the back of a room somewhere.
We decided to go the proper way, through the British government and through the British adoption societies. And prior to that, my wife had got my birth certificate. So she was doing her thing on her side, which is what she's very good at, digging out people. And I went to the British Adoption Agency, and they said, right, the first thing you've got to do is you've got to go and chat to somebody in South Africa, a social worker, just to prepare you for what could come out, because you could have been the product of a rape, anything. It's
okay, that's and interesting.
They need to know that you're strong enough to handle what you're going to find.
Yeah.
And they put me in contact with a lady called Irene Berman, who still remains a friend of mine. She lives in Constantia. I think she's the most amazing woman, and she helped me through all of this.
Yeah.
So we were following the government route, have your interview, do this, send the papers, and meanwhile my wife is on the internet and looking and searching and tapping into roots, and came up with somebody we thought might have known me. Little village, two sisters living together. We thought possibly the one could have been my granny or mm-hmm. my grandma. And I was chatting to Irene about this, and I said, what are we going to do? She says, well, you know, the British government will get there eventually, but she says,
it's going to take time. Mm.
Let's take a chance. Let's write to this family. And she said she would write. And she wrote a letter saying, look, I have a client in South Africa, and we believe that possibly you may know something about his birth and his upbringing. So we got a very nasty letter back saying, oh, I know people have been looking for me on this computer thing, and and nothing to do with it. So, I mean, I was heartbroken.
Complete shutting of the door. Yeah.
And I sat and I chatted to Irene about it, and she said, don't, just go home and write a letter. Write a 40-year letter to your mom telling her how you felt for the last 40 years. So I worked through the night. I wrote the letter, took it to Irene. She read it. She burst into tears and said, we're going to send this. So we sent it off to the UK, and we thought, okay, a week for it to get there, a week for her to think, and maybe a week for an answer to come back. So 3 weeks go, 4 weeks, 5 weeks, 6 weeks, nothing. And I was president of the Master Builders Association at the time. And Heather phones me, my wife, and says, get home. Said, well, it was the quickest recorded meeting ever of the Master Builders Association. I got home. There was a glass of whiskey on the bar for me and a letter. Heather hadn't opened it. It was for me.
It was your reply.
It was the reply saying, I'm sorry, I shouldn't have written the first nasty letter. I am your mom. And
wow.
Yes.
Huge moment. I am your mom and I'm alive. I'm in the UK. And did she immediately say, I'm prepared to meet you? What did she say in that first letter?
She apologized. And she was full of apologies initially. And we wrote back and said, well, we're on our way. I mean, we kind of caught a plane 2 weeks later. We decided we'd just go somewhere in the UK first, just to get ready, not go storming in. And she'd said it all had to be secret. She was staying or looking after her sister, who was also had dementia, and didn't want the sister to know. Nobody had known. This whole thing had been hushed. And she said, you must meet me at 7 o'clock in the morning at the bus stop outside the village, and I'll jump into the car. And
my goodness.
So I kind of set off from York very early in the morning. We've been staying with friends, got to the bus stop, and you're sitting in the car looking in the rearview mirror. I wonder if that's her. No, I don't want that one. It's
sure.
And all of a sudden this lady came up, knocked on the window, got in the car and said, drive. So we drove and we started to talk and we had some coffee and she gave me an envelope and then we stopped and we chatted some more and we'd organized, if everything had worked out, to pick Heather up at lunchtime. She'd caught the train down from York. So we went and we picked Heather up and we spent the afternoon together and my mom took us shopping and that was it. That was goodbye. Thanks. Great to meet you. And she gave me some old family cut glass. She was a collector of antiques. And off we went, and we finished our holiday, and we kept in contact. And we went back a year or 2 years later. Not great with the dates. Took the boys back to meet her. Had a very strange evening, because we were never allowed in the house. Mm-hmm. But by this time, her sister had died, so Heather just kind of put her foot in the door and said, are you inviting us in tonight? Because we'd been the day in the country with her again, and we went in. And I probably had the most embarrassing night of my life. My mom sat there making fun of me. I was fat. I was this. I was everything. I ate too much. And I mean, my kids thought this was hilarious. The boys were rolling around on the floor. But she had a wicked Yorkshire sense of humor. And she'd had a really hard life. And so that was the second visit. And that was the last time I ever saw her. Heather went back again after that. She was over on business. She popped in to see my mom. She thought maybe if she was there alone, because my mom had always said, oh, and there's no father, there's no this, there's no, nobody knows, and he's dead anyway, and blah, 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 blah.
Yeah.
So Heather thought maybe on her own she'd get a bit, but nothing. And then I forgot Mother's Day, because Mother's Day in South Africa is not the same as the UK. It's
yes.
Mothering Sunday there.
Correct.
And, of course, I slipped up the 1 year, and that was it. And the next time she spoke, she said, oh, you don't really love me. That's it. I don't want any more to do with you. You've messed up my life again. And
wow.
Wow. But I will leave you money, she said. That, and she kept her promise when she died. But it was...
I mean, just, there are no words to say how difficult that must have been. So you've already been through making your peace with the loss of her once. To have to do it again must have been incredibly emotionally painful.
It was. It hurt, but... I was glad that we'd met. I think she got freedom out of it, and she and both my moms were similar in a lot of ways. Neither of them, I don't think, ever wanted the chance to be hurt again. When my adopted dad died, my mom became a recluse here as well and was never going to give anybody the chance to hurt her. She didn't really get to know our kids either, because, and my birth mom as well, just put up this whole defensive screen, and that was it.
I mean, I think it's remarkable that you've got that level of, despite being so close to the story, you have a bit of distance to be able to appreciate the situation that she might have been in, and perhaps have. Do you have a sense of feeling that you understand, if not accept, the decision that your birth mother made in giving
up? Oh, yes, definitely. No, it was the right decision, and I would never hold any grudges or anything. I had a super life. She did what she needed. She had been terribly treated by her fiancé. Mm-hmm. Who'd left and gone to Scotland, found somebody else. My mom went in search, came back, went to an office party, and I think I was conceived on the boss's desk.
He's to keep a sense of humor about it, Don. Now, the interesting thing is in that initial meeting with your birth mother, she says, when you ask about who is my father, she says, don't worry about that. He never knew about you, and he's already dead anyway. That wasn't the truth. How did you find that out?
Long, long story, but again, thanks to my super wife, who was just chasing birth certificates and marriage certificates and death certificates. And on my birth certificate, which we got my original out of the British Adoption Agency, it had my father's name and his occupation. So by trial and error, we narrowed the field down, and we found out that I had a couple of brothers. My father, as it turns out, was a bit of a Jack the Lad. He was on wife number four.
Well, okay.
So we decided, how are we going to approach this? And I actually have a cousin in the UK who's also adopted. This is my adopted father's sister, also couldn't have children,
yep.
and she'd adopted. And my cousin had gone down pretty much the same route in the UK. And we decided, well, how are we going to approach this? And she got her son to phone, who we thought was my brother, because you can't, and it's a very important thing with adoption, just don't go barging in. You don't know who you're going to hurt. Mm. We didn't know at this stage if my dad's first wife was still alive, what the story was. It was, so you have to be so, so careful.
Yeah.
Never just go and knock on a door. And so we got my nephew to phone and say he's doing research, and is John Craig still alive, and blah, blah, blah. And we've got someone that's looking at family trees, and he left a phone number. And my cousin phoned me a few weeks later and said, I've just had a phone call. We think it's your father. He was looking for the person doing his family tree. She said, and Fiona said to me, she said, I had to tell him the truth. Mm. She said, I couldn't lie. He's on the phone. And she said to him, do you know you've got a son? And he says, no.
Wow.
A son from the lady that you had the party with at the office all those years ago.
And he did not know.
He didn't know. And he said to her, just give me a couple of weeks. I'm kind of on wife number four now, and I've got to break this news in gently. And she phoned me back 10 minutes later. He's just been back on the phone. He wants you to phone now. Like anything else, he's found a 40-year-old son, and
he wants to know you right now.
Yeah. So the same story. A couple of weeks later, we were back on the plane, and
what was that like for you to meet him?
It was more. I didn't want to go through what I've been through with my mom again. So we went via Scotland, and we kind of turning right to head to Doncaster, I think. And I said that I don't want to do this, and she said we're going. So we drove, and we. Left the suitcases in the car. We got out. His wife number four thought I was there for the money, and she was kind of more my age than his age. And it was, but a couple of bottles of wine, and I cooked for them. You know that I cook as well.
Yep.
So I cooked them a meal and got everybody settled, and a couple of bottles of wine, and it was great. So I saw him the one time, then he actually fell in love with my wife, I think. I mean, big bunches of roses arrived for Heather every other month from the UK, and then he got sick and contact kind of died down a bit. Then we're lying in bed one night and the phone rings and it's wife number four. Just to let you know, your father's in hospital. He's dying. Don't you dare come. We don't want anybody or family to know. Blah, 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 blah. So, yeah, that's not what you say to me.
So I would imagine that you got on a plane the next day.
I phoned the hospital. I said, this is the story. Believe me or believe me not. My father is dying. She says, how quickly can you get here as a lady doctor? I said, Tuesday morning I'll be there. She says, I'll try and keep him alive. I can't promise. I'll do everything that I shouldn't do. She says, when you get here, phone me from the car park. If necessary, we'll put a white coat on you and give you a stethoscope, because if the other family's there and...
To smuggle you into the hospital. Yeah. And that is
what
you did.
And I got there and I saw him for a couple of hours in the afternoon, went to stay with some friends in York in the afternoon, went back the next morning, said goodbye to him and he died.
Sure.
So I met my real mom twice and I met my real dad twice.
You mentioned half-brothers. Have you been able to establish contact with any of them?
Well, that was last year's trip to the UK. We'd been in contact. The one nice thing that wife number four did was she'd kept all the correspondence between my dad and myself. And when he died, he gave it to his other son, my brother Phil. And so we started chatting to each other. And after a while, it took us about 2 years, I think, to build up. Did we want to go, or did I want to go through something again? And we didn't. Last year, we went off to the UK and we spent 5 days with Phil and his wife Helen.
Fantastic.
And now hopefully we're trying to get them out here.
Let's hope. I mean, Don, it's a remarkable story to listen to, because as you said at the start, you had a very happy life with your adoptive parents. There's no suggestion, a whisper of suggestion that you were missing something other than a sense of who you were and where you came from and wanting to know the truth about your roots. But it's obviously been a process that hasn't been without a great deal of pain and emotion involved. With hindsight now, as you sit here talking to me, are you glad that you opened that door and went there looking for both of them?
Yes, I think, and I would recommend to anybody that they do it. You might get bad news, you might find something you don't want to find out, but at the end of the day, you know. I mean, the peace of mind of when our children now go to the doctor, you know what's coming from my side of the family. And it's and you don't think about these as a youngster, but it's important.
Yeah.
I mean, both my birth parents survived cancer in different forms or other, so I know that either are going to be checked regularly and things like, and it's important.
As you said at the start, it was a very different time, and there was such a stigma around adoption at the time that you were born, so much so that today, do you think that times have changed, that people are more comfortable talking about this today? I mean, somebody's just WhatsApped saying the story is bringing tears to my eyes. I think it's so good to share these kinds of stories and let people know that other families have been through this and gone through all this emotion. Do you think there has been a shift?
I think there has been. It's easier to talk about things now, and I think the speed of the world and multimedia and social chatting and everything has made it easier for people to communicate. Maybe a little bit too easy, because like I said at the start, it's you need to ease into this. You can't just go and kick a door down. I mean, my wife gets a lot of inquiries for adoption and she points them straight off to a counselor first. She will not until she knows that they're everybody's on
mentally
the right
ready
path.
To find what might be on the other side of that door.
But I think I've been really, really lucky. I've had two lives, you know, and I often say to myself, is there a book in me? Because I'd like to help other people. I really would. And I say, when did my life really start? Was it the day that my birth parents had sex on the office desk? Or was it the day that Doreen collected me from the adoption agency in Liverpool? And it's a hard toss-up. It's a hard choice, but it's...
I'd like to read that book. And I know you're always threatening to retire and you never do, but perhaps one day you should write that book, Don. I, for one, would like to read it.
The notes are there. Does somebody want to read it? I'm a nobody. I mean, who wants to read a book about somebody's life? I don't know.
Well, judging by the number of people who are wanting to hear it and have been listening, I think the answer is yes. Don McAllister, thank you so much for sharing the story with us
thank
so
you.
Openly. And, I'll be first in line to buy a copy when it's written one day. Okay.
Yes.
Don McAllister, you know him as Handy Mac in our DIY slot, but what a story that is.